Hey there, thanks for pressing play on this AHDB podcast. So, bit of news. Food and Farming and Agonomics have officially been retired. No more episodes coming. But wait, before you wander off into the podcast wilderness, we've got something new, shiny and weekly. It's called The Ag Show. It's got all the good stuff. Farming chats, fresh insights and a whole load of fun. New episodes drop every Wednesday at midday. Just search The Ag Show wherever you get your podcasts to give it a whirl.
Charlotte, Tom, last week it was A-level results day, a massive day for people in school. Now, A-levels were a long time ago for me. What A-levels did you both do?
They were even longer ago for me, Hannah, so don't you worry. I ended up doing biology. Oh God, what did I do? It was that long ago, I can't even remember.
Can't remember.
Biology, food nutrition, and something. I literally can't even remember. It's that long ago. Oh, it was geography.
I was a geography man as well. That's something I'd love to hear.
We've all got geography in common. I did it too.
So we're all pretty good at colouring in, is what we're saying.
Oxbow Lakes, we know about them.
Oh, we love them.
I'm Charlotte Fox-Reese.
I'm Tom Spencer.
And I'm Hannah Clark.
And welcome to your weekly dose of economics and analysis from the world of agriculture in this podcast we call Agonomics.
On this week's show, we're looking at the long-term opportunities for red meat and dairy exports to Europe.
Yeah, I've been catching up with our AHDB colleague Amandeep Kaur Purewal, who says strengthening trade links and maintaining relationships are key to driving exports in European markets.
We might be requiring more export health certificates for shipping red meat and dairy products from the UK to EU. There was a ban in exporting chilled minced red meat and chilled meat preparations to the EU as well. So that will be lifted as well. That's going to be a welcome bit of news for UK exporters.
We're also joined by our analyst, Annabelle Twinborough, to talk about abattoir numbers.
The majority of the processing is done by a small number of these multi-purpose businesses that can kind of bring in economies of scale, as the number of smaller and independent firms has declined a lot faster over those years.
And finally, we've also got this week's big question.
A reminder, new episodes of Agonomics drop at midday on Wednesdays, so follow us wherever you listen to podcasts to make sure you don't miss a show.
And do get in touch. Email us at agonomics@ahdb.org.uk.
Tom, Charlotte, welcome back. Another episode of Agonomics is upon us on this slightly cooler Wednesday. It was a hot one yesterday, wasn't it?
Very.
I do struggle to sleep at night when it is this hot, I do say. Why the UK hasn't adopted air conditioning like the rest of the globe, I do not know.
What are your tips for staying cool in the absence of air conditioning?
Drink lots of water.
Yeah, very sensible. Slip, slap, slop and all of that. Mine's bare feet. Bare feet around the house on a cold floor.
Ooh. Sounds good. Mine would be kicking the husband and the dogs out the bed so that you don't have four extra body heats kicking out at you at night. That's the most sensible thing to do.
Yeah, it's starfish weather, isn't it? For sure. What have we been reading in the news then, team? Charlotte, you've got something for us, haven't you?
Yeah, so I've been reading about how the UK's food and farming sectors are facing a growing crisis. So that's a shortage of skilled and qualified workers. And it's really beginning to bite across the whole supply chain. So I've read a couple of reports recently from The Grocer, which reveal how a shortage of skilled and qualified workers is placing unprecedented pressure on producers. And that's both in the dairy and meat sectors. So dairy co-op Arla Foods has warned that this labour gap is now a direct threat to food security, and not just being that annoying recruitment headache. Because without enough trained staff, the industry risks falling behind on productivity, innovation and sustainability goals. Meanwhile, in the meat sector, it's struggling with tighter immigration rules and policy shifts that have made it harder to recruit essential workers. And that's especially in abattoirs and processing plants. So for our HDB levy payers, really, this isn't just all about a policy issue. It's because becoming a business one too. Labour shortages are really impacting on outputs, the rising costs and increasing reliance on imports for supplying our supermarkets perhaps. And it affects everything from the availability of British produce on supermarket shelves to the resilience of our food systems. And that's particularly evident when we have global shocks. So think about the pandemic when everything was going a bit wild and you couldn't go out and buy your pasta or whatever on shelves. So really, we are going to be having to look at what we can do to improve training pipelines and access to skilled labour, just so that the UK can maintain its ability to produce high quality homegrown food. And actually, I think that's really important. Reason why AHDB continues to support training programmes. So things such as Entrepreneurs in Dairy, the Pig Industry Scholarship Programme, and both of which are actually open at the moment. So applications are live until the end of August. But also thinking more at that grassroots level. So the work which our education team does to help increase children's understanding of where their food's actually coming from and raise the profile of different jobs which are available within the agricultural sector, so we can supply that homegrown talent for the future. And I think actually it's quite fitting that really, this was my news story, seeing as we have got Annabelle on this week to talk about what's been happening with some of the abattoir numbers within the UK.
So your article, can you just set the scene firstly? So could briefly explain the role that the red meat processing sector plays in the wider beef and lamb supply chain.
Yeah, so when we're looking at the processing sector, this is covering abattoirs, cold storage facilities, cutting and other processing sites. So it's a really vital link in the chain. So meat production needs to be assisted by appropriate and accessible infrastructure for these purposes. And the importance of the processing goes beyond the cattle and sheep sectors. So it's national importance for consumers and food self-sufficiency as well.
So your article begins with the consolidation of the processing sector. So what can you tell us about that?
We're looking between 2019 and 2024, the number of abattoirs processing cattle and sheep reduced by 16% for cattle and 15% for sheep. And the majority of the processing is done in these smaller abattoirs, and it's these smaller independent firms which have seen the majority of that decline.
So, Annabelle, how has the processing sector become more consolidated in recent years?
So between 2019 and 2024, the number of abattoirs processing cattle and sheep reduced by 16% and 15% respectively. The majority of the processing is done by a small number of these multi-purpose businesses that can kind of bring in economies of scale, as the number of smaller and independent firms has declined a lot faster over those years.
One of the main reasons why we're seeing consolidation in this in the kind of processing sector, in that really key part of the red meat supply chain, is to do with small abattoirs. There's a lot of pressures facing these kind of smaller enterprises, isn't there? What have you kind of picked out of your analysis on this topic of small abattoirs in particular?
So small abattoirs play a really important part, as well as the social and the welfare benefits that they bring. They provide businesses to farmers and butchers and rural communities. So they offer services like private kill, which enables small businesses to sell directly to consumers. If you have a look on the Sustainable Food Trust website, they detail numerous benefits of small and localised benefits and all these vital services that they provide.
And we talked about labour. Charlotte talked about labour earlier in her news piece. I mean, that's just one of the factors that, I guess, pressurises these businesses. There's almost a disproportionate effect of costs on these smaller businesses, and hence why there's pressure on these vital links in the chain, really. I guess that's what's causing, consolidation. But as you said, these smaller abattoirs are so important, and they link more widely into maintaining food security. Because as you say, they give producers that local route to market, which has several benefits for things like animal welfare, as well as creating diverse options for sale of meat and animals. So I think it's a really, really important topic that you touched on in this piece.
Yeah, we touched on economies of scale and how it is easier for those larger abattoirs in many ways, and high operating costs, which are increasing, and that's likely to incentivize further economies of scale. And that ability that the larger abattoirs have to kind of integrate with other businesses and negotiate deals and get favourable prices and reduce their waste, because we all know that carcass balance is such a big issue. So it's a lot easier for those bigger businesses to make use of the whole carcass. And then there's increasing food safety, traceability and welfare regulations. So just one example is that the abattoirs have to have a vet on site at all times. And if you're having more throughputs, then obviously that cost is diluted down with those bigger businesses.
It's really important to have a diverse mix of processing capacity and abattoir and killing options for the supply chain across the country, whether it be large multi-site businesses or whether it's smaller, more bespoke options at a more local level for maybe smaller producers. Annabelle, I'm interested in your analysis and what you found could be the opportunities for these types of businesses in the supply chain.
There are opportunities for smaller abattoirs to maybe diversify or collaborate with other facilities to improve their long-term prospects. And they have a lot of benefits and unique selling points that they could communicate and hopefully get to the consumer, and the consumer will then be prepared to pay that extra cost to receive those benefits. So, for example, opening a butcher's shop might enable the business to capitalise on local benefits and quality of the product as well. Or, like I said, collaboration with maybe a larger abattoir and get access to resources. You talked earlier about the problems with recruiting and staff. If they were able to access something like butchery training, that could come as a benefit for both parties involved.
I'm going to jump in here with my personal experience that I have with small abattoirs. So I've said before, my husband's a butcher on here, small family-owned butchers, and the small abattoirs are incredibly important for supplying him. It means that he can have access to British beef, lamb, and our small abattoir as well also does pigs. So he knows and has confidence when he's talking to his customers that, yeah, this chop or this steak has come from so-and-so's farm from down the road. And that's a really important selling point for him. And if he was having to go and access meat, he probably wouldn't be able to get it from some of the larger abattoirs because of the volumes that they would need to be buying. He would not be classified as large enough as a customer base for those abattoirs. So it's incredibly important that for the industry, for retailers, particularly butchers, that these small abattoirs remain. And I think you've got some personal experience with using them too, haven't you, Annabelle?
So as much as I do use those normal channels, I had some really great experience using private kill facilities as well. It's enabled me to do some direct selling of our organic beef at home, and consumers really like the fact that they know exactly where that animal came from. So really value both of those very different channels, but I do really think there is an important place for the smaller abattoirs as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Annabelle. There's two sides to this coin. There's feeding the world and that high production that the world needs with that growing population, and there is a huge place for those major abattoirs, but also a key market, as you pointed out, for those smaller abattoirs.
And on that note, I think it's time that we take a short break. We'll see you on the other side.
Once again, you're joined by myself, Tom, Charlotte and Hannah. We have talked about the domestic side of agronomics. Now I think it's time to go abroad. Isn't that right, Hannah?
Yeah, and I assume you don't mean going on holiday like producer Martin did for the last 2 weeks. We've missed you, Martin, by the way. Although producer Alice did a fantastic job of stepping in.
She did, and I have to apologise to Charlotte and to the three of you. I didn't bring anything back for you, although we've had pretty nice weather, so I'd argue I brought the sun.
No fridge magnets.
No. No ice creams.
But yeah, we have talked about the domestic side of the market, and another really important route for sales is exports. So I caught up with our colleague Amandeep, who has recently led a piece of research into export prospects and what the opportunities are for UK red meat and dairy exports abroad. In this most recent report, the team, and I know you were involved in this, Tom, weren't you? We looked at the European market in particular. So I began by asking Amandeep about what her research is all about.
This particular report is looking at export opportunities for UK agri-food exports around the globe, basically. The one I'm going to talk to you specifically today is focused on Europe, and I'll go into why that is in a moment. But basically, we're looking at primarily for red meat and dairy exports in the UK. What are our target markets across the world, and the reasons why they are the target markets and why they'd be a good place for those exports to go to? So we initially did this report a couple of years ago, back in 22, 23, where we covered the whole globe and then pinpointed the areas which were the main focal points for red meat and dairy. And what we're doing now is just going back to revisit some of those, updating some of the analysis. And we've started off with Europe in the first instance of those regions, because it is by far the most important market for UK agri-food exports. We're going to look at them and looking at the various categories that we sort of look to characterise what makes that area so promising for exports. So we look at it in quite a bit of detail. We look at, first of all, the economic prospects of that area. So, you know, what is a typical GDP? What's the sort of economic forecast for that area? Are people fairly wealthy to buy red meat and dairy, etc.? Also, you know, what's the population growth, etc. there as well? And then we have a look at consumption patterns. So how much are they consuming already? And then what are they forecast to consume over the next decade? Using OECD forecasts for different products. Then we look at market access and trade barriers. So have we got an agreement in place? Have we got our export health certificates in place to send our red meat and dairy there? What are their tariff rates like for imports? Do they pose a barrier, or are they okay? And then we also look at, for example, have they got any agreements with other countries which, you know, will be our competitors and will then, you know, we'll have to compete with? So cover all of that. And then we go to the sort of the demand side, which is looking at what do consumers in that region think of British product? What are the kind of key factors they look for? Is it standards? Is it quality? Is it affordability? And then recently for this update, which will be then replicated for the other regions going forward, is the route to market section, which is now looking at it from the perspective of importance within that region. So the buyers that are going to buy those UK product, what are they looking at from that perspective in terms of what do they want for sending on to retail or food service? What kind of things are they looking at to sort of like buy that UK product? So that's going to give some insight to exporters as well.
So it's a massive report. There's so much evidence in there. And you mentioned Europe as a market and its value to the UK. You might think the EU is not an exciting or new kind of exotic market that we've entered. We've traded with Europe for decades. How important is the European market to UK export of red meat and dairy?
By far the most important. So, like, which is why we've focused on it. So, for example, like you said, it might not be as exciting and shiny as a new, you know, one across the globe. Or, you know, we've recently got one with India, for example, that's just been published, etc. But if you look at it in terms of the actual data, so 83% of our UK red meat, which is, you know, fresh meat, frozen meat, offal, in value terms, 83% of that goes to the EU and plus dairy products as well. So that's huge. And that's based on the sort of recent 3-year average. And also, if you look at in volume terms, that's nearly 3/4 of those exports. So that really just highlights how important Europe and, you know, EU and the rest of Europe are to UK agri-food exports.
While the EU is not necessarily a new market for the UK, we've seen quite a bit of change in the trading relationship over the past few years. Well, Brexit was obviously a huge change. More recently, we've seen alterations to the SPS, the sanitary and phytosanitary requirements across the bloc and for that trade. Can you explain a bit more about what exactly has happened?
Yeah, so as you remember, when the UK left the EU, obviously, you know, the relationship slightly changed in terms of how easy it was to do trade with our number one partner. Obviously, with the trade and cooperation agreement, we still could send things to the EU tariff-free and could, due to that tariff, due to that agreement, which was, you know, obviously very welcome, because we know we had that cliff edge during Brexit. Was it going to become a third country? So having that agreement in place, that meant that, okay, we don't have, can still trade on a tariff-free basis. But there was that trade friction that followed afterwards, that in the form of that additional paperwork, you know, the border checks that were in place as well. I'm still in place at the moment. And then, you know, it made that a previously smooth operation just more burdensome. That kind of disproportionately was a bit more of a disadvantage to the small scale exporters who had to, like, you know, that cost was more for them compared to, like, the bigger exporters as well. So recently in May, when they had the UK-EU trade summit, that's kind of paving the way for a bit more of a removing or reducing those barriers, so to speak. For example, we won't require any more export health certificates for shipping red meat and dairy products from the UK to EU. There was a ban in exporting chilled minced red meat and chilled meat preparations to the EU as well. So that will be lifted as well. But we haven't got the timings at the moment, but, you know, that progress has been made. So we're just waiting for the timings to be released. But that's going to be a welcome bit of news for UK exporters.
Definitely. I think that will be very beneficial. I know we don't know exactly when that kind of situation will change exactly, but that is another, you know, massive opportunity, I think, for us as UK export. I wondered if we could now go back into the report and maybe explore the opportunities that you've identified in the analysis for UK red meat and dairy.
We've been trading with the EU for a while now. It's our main trading partner. And if you look at EU and the Europe as a whole, it's a developed, a fairly mature market. So there's little growth forecast for consumption of red meat, especially over the next decade, because it's fairly, you know, as I said, fairly mature market. But there are areas that the UK can take advantage of. For example, in high value premium beef in markets such as France and Italy. So it's well regarded there in terms of there's space there to grow in that avenue. And then also in the growing halal markets in France, Germany and Lebanon, there's opportunity for lamb in those markets and take advantage of that growth there. And then we've got these sort of niche markets in Northern Europe as well for premium land, like particularly Switzerland. So we're in the middle of doing like a negotiation with a trade deal for Switzerland as well. So that's another, you know, opportunity that we can focus on in there. For cheese, there is growth forecast for cheese, unlike for red meat. So cheese consumption in Europe is forecast to grow by about just over 5% out to the next decade. And UK cheese is quite well positioned to benefit from strong demand. So cheddar's in, you know, quite high demand in retail markets in France and Germany. And then we've got that regionally protected products such as Stilton, and also in the sort of specialty added value, those niche markets as well. UK cheese got a place there to take hold, you know, make more of an inroads into those markets as well.
So there's quite a bit of risk, I guess, potentially to UK export generally. And having evidence like this report is really important to make sure we are targeting our export work in the most lucrative and most rewarding markets. The evidence is one thing. I guess having those relationships as well is really important, and making sure that we can maximise the value of those relationships and get the most out of that trade with those markets.
Yeah, exactly. So we're quite, like you say, we're quite in a tumultuous trading environment at the moment globally, not just in trading environments, but like geopolitical events, etc. So it's about looking at if we look at the UK-EU, for example, how do we maintain this trading relationship we've got and strengthen it, but then still have the opportunity elsewhere? And like a key example I can give for that is, yeah, we've just had talks to, you know, strengthen that EU-UK trade agreement. But at the same time, we've got the US knocking on the UK's door as well for agreements. So their sort of viewpoint on standards, etc., is very different from, well, quite different from the EU's kind of like phytosanitary requirements. So it's how do you balance what the opportunities elsewhere, for example, the US, with the current strong relationship we've got with the EU. And that's going to be the thing to navigate. So we've got to make sure that we can still carry on trading effectively and easily with the EU, and then, you know, within those guidelines. But then if we're doing deals elsewhere, that doesn't jeopardise what we've got with the EU, because like I said, we keep referring to, it's our biggest market. So these things have to be carefully balanced, and we're going to see how we can navigate through that, which is quite difficult in this current climate.
So, of course, having the evidence like this report, Amandeep, is really important to make sure that we're targeting our export work in the right places. I wonder if you could just sum up maybe with the key value of this report to levy payers in the wider industry.
One of the key things, I suppose, is the relationships that you have with buyers in those areas, and it's maintaining that trade relationship. So in the EU, we've already got those relationships set up from, you know, previously, and it's about maintaining those relationships and then finding scope to build on new ones and, you know, grow that network. And then that's the same for any sort of area where we look to expand our exports, I suppose. So it's about how do we strengthen and build on those relationships. And that's why we've got our exports team here that help to do that on the ground, basically. So export team have their own region around the world. So someone focuses on the Americas, got Asia market, the Middle East, North Africa region, for example. They're on the ground there. They're making those contacts with people, the buyers, etc. They're explaining the benefits of UK produce and like building those links between UK exporters and the buyers in those regions. You know, the trade shows that the export team go on is highlighting, is promoting UK red meat and dairy, so that buyers in those markets know exactly what's available. They've got the chance to meet each other. They, you know, like we said in the work we saw, the route to market section, it's those relationships that are going to be key, really. You know, the consumption forecast, etc., all very well, but the trade is going to be done by people talking to each other and knowing that what product I'm getting from the UK is of what I want. It's reliable. I like the reputation of it. I know the people involved with it. I know what I'm going to get. These are kind of, as a business person or like as a person who's running a business, these are the kind of things you want to know about, and it's building those relationships. And that is the key, I think, and that's why our export team helped to facilitate.
Welcome back to the Agonomics podcast with Tom, Hannah and me, Charlotte. Make sure you're subscribed to the pod. New episodes drop on a Wednesday. Hannah, that sounded so interesting, your chat with Amandeep. But yeah, Tom, I know you've been doing some work on this too.
Yeah, that's right, Charlotte. I had the opportunity to get involved in, well, two sections. One, which was the consumer insights side of things.
Ooh, the dark side. Welcome.
Yes, exactly. I got to see all the wonders of how the European market is thinking about red meat and dairy when they're making their food choices. But also on top of that, I was looking at a new segment of the report, which was routes to market, where I got to speak with a number of our AHDB export team that are sort of based in European countries. Particularly ones I spoke to were from France, from Germany and from the Netherlands. And they were giving some really good insight into how a UK exporter can access the market within the country that they're based, the sort of tips and tricks, things to focus on, a lot of sort of consistency of product, some of which were down to what the benefits of the UK product that we're producing and how we can advertise that to the European market and hopefully increase those exports and boost agriculture in the UK.
Out of interest, Tom, did you sign up for helping on this report because you thought, like Hannah did earlier in the year, she had that lovely trip to London and a very nice dinner because she was looking at exports? Did you sign up on the promise of a nice dinner?
That wasn't on the corner of my mind, I'm not going to lie, thinking, oh, European, oh, and it's sort of happening over the summer. I thought, oh, here we go. Sadly, no, I was in the Midlands, where I have been all year. But I am not complaining. There were some really interesting people there to talk to who were actually in those sunny countries. So at least I got to hear how sunny it was.
I can definitely recommend getting out and about with the exports team. Really interesting. You meet a lot of really interesting people and really get under the skin of how like foreign trade operates. Quite literally is a whole new world.
They are some very passionate people, 100%.
Well, I am definitely going to be looking forward to reading this report now. You've wet my whistle.
Yes, that's right. And you can access that report. It's live now on the AHDB website, ahdb.org.uk. And the title of that is Prospects for UK Agri-Food Exports Europe.
But if you can't remember that, we'll also put the link in the show notes.
Very sensible. I would forget.
I think it's now time for our big question. So, Martin, what have we got this week?
Well, just quickly, having heard you talk about your A-levels at the top of this show, I do feel qualified to speak on agronomics as I join you as a fellow scholar of the subject of geography. So I studied that at A-levels, though I think I have to go further back because it's the summer of Oasis, and actually Oasis were just about to release their first album when I got my results. So it was a long time ago. Anyway, you asked me about this week's question that's been posed. It is, when it comes to agriculture and economics, what do the terms bullish and bearish mean?
It always makes me think literally of a bull and a bear. I'm not going to lie. I think it's a great term. We have some really boring terms in agriculture, but that is not one of them.
It's a bit of old school trading jargon that we do use quite often, actually, in economics when we talk about markets moving up and down. And that's fundamentally what the bulls and the bears are all about. Isn't that right, Tom?
That is right, yes. Quite on topic, the fact that we've got bullish and we're talking about it in the agricultural sense. So the way I like to remember it, you've got bullish, which means the market sentiment is thinking things are going to rise. And you've got bearish, which is the opposite of that, with market sentiment thinking that price is going to fall. I think a bull thrusts its horns upwards, so market sentiment's up, and a bear swipes its paws downwards. That's my way of sort of market sentiment down. And that may work for you, but it does for me.
I think it was actually, was it you, Hannah, that told me this in like my first week at AHDB, or it might have been Freya. And it was, when it says bullish, think of a bull pushing at a gate because they want to get out. Like they're trying to push out, they're really thrusting forward. When you think about a bear, they're hibernating. And when they're hibernating, they're not eating. So they're starting to waste away a bit. So that's how I think of it. Bullish, going up, bearish, shrinking.
I don't think that was me, Charlotte, but yeah, it works.
Yeah, it's important to mention that when we're talking about this, that if someone says that the market is bullish, that doesn't mean it will go up. It's just a feeling that is coming from the market. It's not a fact. So markets can be bullish one week and bearish the next, depending on new data, weather, policy, global events. It all encompasses what the sort of market sentiment might be.
Sentiment's the key word there, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, never mind bullish and bearish. Bull and bear pub? Is that not how you operate?
Let's go down the bull and bear for a pint.
Yeah. Say it's sunny enough. Drinks are on you, eh, Martin?
Don't go too far. I know I promised you something from Mallorca, but yeah.
One day, Charlotte, one day you'll get something out of Martin.
Okay.
Maybe there's a leaving do happening this week, isn't there?
You're not going to be paying for any drinks at that, Martin. You know damn well you won't be.
we'll get Graham to pay for them.
You'll just bring them over to me.
Yeah, that'll be it.
I think on that note, it's probably time to plug something we've got coming up next week, when we actually have sat down with Graham and had a great little chat with him, didn't we, Hannah, about his time at AHDB and what he might like to leave as little words of wisdom for future CEOs for us.
Yeah, we talked about all sorts of things, from how to be a good CEO, general leadership, which starts with good tea bags and ice cream.
It hasn't started to drip down my fingers.
I was just going to say, how has that not started to melt yet?
It's because Jim has the temperature set in this room. If I'm in, I'm like in a cold store with my ice cream. It's actually going, it's freezing back up.
So stay tuned for that next week.
I think that's probably all we've got time for this week on Agonomics. Thank you for joining us and listening to the end. Don't forget that new episodes drop every Wednesday at midday.
And if you have a topic or a question you've always wanted to ask or hear us talk about on the pod, please do get in touch with us. You can drop us a message. You can email us at agonomics@ahdb.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. See you next week.
Bye. Bye.